Hey everyone, thanks for listening to Limited Engagement. I'm your host for the show, Jared Duran. My guest on this episode is singer-songwriter Emma Swift, who has a new album out called Blonde on the Tracks, and we'll get into that in just a minute here. I think this is the third time that I've tried recording this fucking introduction, and normally I have no problem sitting here and riffing off of some topic that's just floating through my head, and it's what I do. It's one of the things that I enjoy about doing this podcast is the time to just sort of work through something for a few minutes before getting into the interview, and I just can't fucking seem to do it this time. I, to be honest, I have been dealing with one of the worst bouts of depression that I've had in a really long time. And, it's made it feel almost impossible to do anything. And, somewhat ironically, it's actually a little bit of, something that I touch on in my conversation with Emma Swift coming up here. You know, when you deal with depression, when you're in it, it can feel, it's a physical ailment almost, you know, like there's just this weight, this heaviness that sits on you, crushing you, just making it hard to breathe and to think and to process. And it's what makes it physically difficult to get up in the morning and to get moving and to do what you need to for the day, because it just feels like too fucking much. And that's what I'm dealing with right now. I feel like I haven't been able to write anything. My normal coping mechanisms of playing guitar and sitting and reading something, or I just can't fucking concentrate on anything either. It just doesn't. I don't see the point in it right now. And I know it's temporary. And right now, this is just one of those things that I got to write out. But, you know, when you're in it, it's difficult to see that. And it's one of those things where I don't want, you know, I just need to, my impulse right now and what I'm following essentially is just to kind of turtle, you know, to crawl into my shell and not really, I don't feel like talking to anybody. You know, I talked to my buddy Jason the other day for the other podcast I do with him, and he's essentially, you know, the only person I've had a conversation with in the past week or so. And you know, I'm lucky. I mean, I have a guy for that. He's my guy for that, because he's also been open about his struggles with that. And, I'm lucky to have that outlet. I know a lot of people are struggling and they don't have an outlet. People, if they're being smart, they're staying home as much as possible. And when you're home and you're alone and you're dealing with this kind of thing, you honestly have never felt so fundamentally isolated. So, you know, I'm doing what I can, and I am having to be all right with that. You know, I'm kind of proud of myself. Normally, historically, I have dealt with depression in very unhealthy ways, by drinking heavily or by eating, overeating, you know, eating in very unhealthy ways, or lashing out at my, at whoever my partner has been at the time. Or just not talking to them and making, you know, causing them to lash out at me due to not being able to communicate. But instead of all of that, I'm actually processing all of this, and it's very painful and it feels insurmountable. But I do feel better about it. And it helps that it's you know, cooled down enough around here to be able to get out and go on a hike or go for a little bit of a run. You know, thankfully, I'm able to do those things again after having broken my foot and being kind of out of commission for the last 3 months. It's nice to be able to do that again. I honestly don't know right now what I would do if I couldn't have that release. You know, luckily I moved into this area where I can get out and walk places. I can go walk to the record store, you know, up the street to Stinkweeds and flip through some records for a little bit, and I can go over to Changing Hands just a little further up the street and browse through the books for a little while, or walk to the grocery store or the restaurants that are around, and be in, you know, to have that, just the physical activity of walking is helpful. And there are a couple of things, you know, I haven't even been able to really, until I was able to this weekend, finally concentrate on a film and actually, you know, enjoy it. But like this entire span of time, I haven't even been able to get into, you know, watching any sort of like narrative television show. It's just been too, I can't follow any of it. And it's kind of funny that in this time that we're in, you know, you've got these people that are, you know, whose art I've admired for a long time, kind of being open and putting themselves out there on these Instagram live things. I've been watching Marc Maron's stream every morning, and you know, his daily advice of doing, you know, using whatever options you have at your disposal to maintain your sanity without hurting yourself or others, and kind of watching him has been sort of therapy for my, you know, a version of therapy for me. Just kind of hear somebody else going through something. And I keep watching the Tweety show in the evening, and there's something about this family's dynamic and, of course, the music that they play that just, I don't know, it works its way in, and I can feel a little relief for a while. So, you know, I know that I'm not alone. I know a lot of people are suffering from, you know, people who may have even not been dealing with depression before or dealing with depression now. And I've been reading and hearing about suicide rates going up, and having dealt with this for a long time, since I was a kid, pretty much, I know that these periods end. I also, you know, now know the importance of actually writing it out consciously and processing. And you do need to find a way to work through it, either on your own or with assistance. And there are, you know, reach out to a friend you trust. There's a lot of you know, services online now that you can talk to somebody. And of course, if you are having that type of crisis, there's, you know, the suicide prevention hotline. But I mean, these things are temporary and we do work through them, and the future can look bleak, but it's also what we make it. And things do get better. It may not be the way that you wish they would get better. Life's a crazy fucking thing, and it 99% of the time doesn't go to plan. But something happens and you get out of it. So like I said, you know, I talked to Emma Swift. It was a wonderful conversation. She's an amazing singer. She's got this album that came out in August called Blonde on the Tracks. You can get it. She released it independently on the label that she and Robin Hitchcock founded, called Tiny Ghost Records. You can get it through Bandcamp. And you can, in a lot of places, you can get it through your local record store too. So check with them and see if you can get it from them. It's a fantastic album. It's one of my favorite albums of the year. Dylan covers are not easy to do. At least not easy to do them justice. There are a lot of bad Dylan covers out there, but there are some wonderful albums of Dylan music as well, interpreted by others. And it's like its own language, and you find your interpretation. The aforementioned Robin Hitchcock is amazing at it. His Dylan Sings album is great. Brian Ferry, his album Dylan-esque. And of course, if you go back, there's The Byrds and Joan Baez and Judy Collins. And I would put this album in a league with that. It's absolutely brilliant. Starting December 9th, it's going to be available on streaming services such as Apple Music and Spotify. And then on December 13th, she's doing a streaming acoustic performance of the songs from Blonde on the Tracks on her YouTube channel. In the show notes, I'm going to put a link to all of that stuff. But definitely check it out. It's absolutely fantastic. And this conversation was wonderful to talk to her. So I'm going to stop my rambling and let you hear that conversation and see you on the other side. Have you been doing a lot of press for the album?
Yeah, I've been really lucky. There's been a lot of interest in the record, which has been great. It's sort of died off in the past couple of weeks a bit, I think just because of the election. So it's
which, hey, very... they called it.
Yay! The end of the longest week ever. But I think that there's been a lot of focus on that, for obvious reasons and important reasons. I'm really glad that I put my record out in August, because I feel I'm kind of seeing folks who've put out records in October and November, and it's like no one's paying attention because it's really hard.
It seems like it has to be a really fairly large name to stand out above it, you know. But I was kind of boggled to see that there were some pretty big albums being released in the last few weeks. You know, Elvis Costello put one out, Springsteen put one out. I'm like, okay. I mean, it was a nice distraction, but it's kind of interesting timing.
Yeah.
I want to come to the Dylan record and talk a lot about that, but I've actually been wanting to do this interview with you for quite some time, actually, because I hadn't known about you or your music at all, and then I I guess it's about a little over 4 years ago, I interviewed Robin and heard you for the first time in Tucson, and I was blown away by your voice. It's stunning. And became an immediate fan. So I've been looking, you know, forward to being able to do this for some time. I'm also fascinated by Australia, and I haven't had a lot of occasion to talk to many people from there. And I have to admit that the extent of my knowledge about Australia is almost entirely music based. You know, I know that 2/3 of the original lineup of Crowded House come from there. You know, I know the Go Betweens come from there, and you know, it seems like, and of course, Peter Carey is one of my favorite writers of all time. And so, you know, I've read his writing on Sydney, but it's you know, it's almost like another world. So I am kind of curious, what was it like to grow up there? And please, you know, I know it's a big place. Where did you grow up in relation to like major cities and culture and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked, because not that many people do, actually. I get a lot of questions about Nashville, because that's where I've been living for the past 7 years. But I am Australian, and I was born in Sydney and then raised kind of all over the place. My parents were kind of wandering school teachers, and we lived in a lot of small country towns on the east coast of Australia. And then as soon as I reached college age, I went back to Sydney, because I like rock and roll and bands and the metropolis and bookstores, and the regional life didn't hold much appeal for me. But Australia is a really fascinating place to grow up culturally, because it's this huge landmass. It's massive, but there's only 23 million people living on the island. And it's got the influences of the indigenous culture, of the Aboriginal people, who were the first people to inhabit the country. And then it's also got the British colonial influence. And then for someone from my generation, particularly growing up in the 80s and the 90s, the American influence and American television and music came in pretty, in a pretty big way. So it's funny, because we have our own cultural identity, but then we, you know, I was, you know, from the age of 8 quoting The Simpsons, and yeah, I've made this record of Bob Dylan songs. I didn't make a record of Go Between songs or Crowded House songs. Sure. or anything like that. So it's a kind of fascinating place. It's really beautiful. It's a very, it's geographically, I think it's the most beautiful place I've ever lived and ever will live. You know, you've got the beach and the desert and the wildlife that's extraordinary. I mean, that's the thing that makes me the most homesick. If I get on the phone to my sister or my best friend, and I can hear rainbow lorikeets tweeting in the background. And so that gives me a certain yearning. For your American listeners, I guess the best way to describe Sydney is it's a little bit like a cross between San Francisco and Los Angeles. But you know, when you're in California and you can smell the eucalyptus trees, that is a very that's the closest I think the States gets to geographically feeling the way that Australia does.
Now, I'm curious, since you did bring it up, does Australia have a Bob Dylan, and is it Paul Kelly?
I think that Australia's actually got a lot of really fantastic songwriters. And Paul Kelly is perhaps our most celebrated songwriter. But that to me is also problematic, because the market is so small in Australia that it's like there's only room to have one, Whereas in America, you can have Dylan, but you can also have Springsteen, and you can adopt Neil Young from Canada.
Sure.
And you can also adopt Joni Mitchell. And then you've got Paul Simon as well, and a lot of classic songwriters, where in Australia there seems to be this media thing where it's like, oh, well, nope, we've got Paul Kelly. That's it. And he becomes the guy. Whereas there's actually a lot of people who write really fantastic songs.
Of course. That was the one I'm most familiar with. But I don't know if you sort of tangentially claim Neil Finn, but I mean, Colin Hay is amazing, and of course I love Forster McLennan. I mean, Robert Forster is as a lyricist, one of the great poets, and you've got Nick Cave too. I mean, come on.
Well, that's it. I mean, we've got Nick Cave. The Nick Cave, I feel like I've got more in common with Nick Cave, in that Nick Cave had to get out of Australia to make a career for himself.
Sure.
And so his career sort of resonates with me a little bit more than, say, someone like Paul Kelly's. Though I'm definitely a fan of both songwriters. And then, you know, we've got Casey Chambers, mm-hmm. who's a more on the Americana vein, who's a great songwriter. We've got Archie Roach, a fantastic songwriter of Indigenous background, who has written a lot of really incredible songs about his life. But not all of it leaves the island, and not all of it gets marketed to the outside world. I mean, I think in some ways that's getting a little bit easier now because of the internet. So you're getting artists like Courtney Barnett, mm-hmm.
She's amazing. She's fantastic.
She's fantastic, and she's also a quintessential Australian songwriter. You know, she sings in an Australian accent, and a lot of her references, like Paul Kelly, are geographical references that are based in Melbourne. But she's sort of known the world over, which is really cool. She used to be in a relationship with a woman called Jen Kloa, and they started Milk Records, their label, together. And Jen Kloa is another great, fabulous Australian songwriter. I mean, lots of them. I'll make you a playlist.
It's interesting because it definitely, I mean, I sought certain things out as a kid. You know, I like to, you know, I think that my, you know, real musical taste started forming around 10, 11, 12, 13. And, you know, when I first heard Nebraska, and then I got into Elvis Costello and Tom Waits, and then Elvis Costello opened that whole door to getting into like Billy Bragg and into Robin Hitchcock and into Squeeze, and a lot of, you know, I became an Anglophile for a really long time. And then it's just, I mean, I think though that and, you know, that's one of the amazing things about music and about record stores and that kind of culture in particular, where you can kind of get turned on to things just by following all these different branches and getting into all of that. And I'm curious, how did you sort of, you know, find yourself getting into music and developing your voice as a singer and deciding that a career in music was something that you wanted to pursue?
It was a really long journey. I was always into music and singing since I was a kid. I really got into my parents' record collection fairly heavily, because I lived in a country town and there were only two radio stations, and one was the pop station and one was the classic rock station. So I've got quite middle-aged tastes in a way, even though I'm not yet middle-aged, just because I listened to a lot of classic rock growing up. I taught myself to sing listening to Linda Ronstadt records. And the great thing about listening to her records is that she picked so many wonderful songs for people like Warren Zevon and Elvis Costello, yeah. who you've mentioned, and the McGarrigle sisters. So, you know, and this is before the internet, I could read the record sleeve and go, well, who are these people that wrote these songs? And then go down to the local record store and be like, oh, Excitable boy. Cool. I might pick this up. Oh, my aim is true. What else is on this record? So that's how I got into it. And then real life got in the way for me for a while. I left school and I became a journalist. Most of my music stuff kind of got put on pause while I tried my hand at the real world, which I wasn't very good at because I was getting up at 4 a.m. to read the news at 5 a.m. on a radio station in Sydney, but I would be out in the bar till midnight watching rock and roll bands.
It's a tough turnaround.
So it wasn't a very compatible life, but it was a fun one, and eventually I started volunteering at a radio station in Sydney, and I put together a folk and Americana and indie rock show. It was very influenced by my love of classic country, things like George Jones and Tammy Wynette and Dolly Parton and Patsy Cline, but also my love of Bill Callahan and the Silver Jews. Mm. And people like Bill Callahan and David Berman, to me there was a real through line, a very obvious through line.
Absolutely.
Between classic country and indie rock and roll, which I thought was fabulously cool. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to explore that on the radio. And I did, and part of that job was doing interviews with touring bands. And eventually I was just like, I want to do that. I'm going to pick up my guitar and do that. So that's what I did.
And have you always been writing songs? I read that as a songwriter you have a very slow process, that it doesn't. So does that mean that it doesn't necessarily come naturally to you, or do you hear, you know, are you a writer that that sort of has melodies that kind of going through and lyrics may or may not come naturally? How is your process and kind of, you know, when did you begin it and sort of develop it?
I think I've always been a quite late bloomer in that respect. I didn't have a great deal of confidence about what I was writing. And I do like to take things slowly with writing because it's easier to stand by a song if you've sat with it for a little bit longer and gone, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. I wrote that song 3 years ago. I still like it. It can come out now. I'm not prolific in any way. I'm always formulating things. I'm always writing things down and having melodies in my head. I've got, you know, over 200 voice memos on my phone that I really need to get back to. But what I tend to do is be a little bit like a magpie and gather fragments and sentences and then put it all together.
Building a nest out of it.
Yeah, building a nest out of it. For example, I've only written one song this year, but I have so many fragments of other songs, and I'm currently putting together a record, and I'll probably just sit down for 2 months with those things and go, okay, it's time to get them out. And I don't know, I think that's because just the way I process how I feel about the world changes so much, and it's just, I'm really slow to acknowledge my feelings, you know. and also too, I think sometimes it's songwriting to me is quite scary. It's like sometimes it's because I'm very inspired by the confessional poets like Robert Lowell and Sylvia Plath. Songwriting to me goes to a place that I don't always want to go to. Sometimes it's just nicer to be, if I was writing songs like I Want to Hold Your Hand,
sure.
or Love Is the Drug, then maybe I'd pick up the guitar more often, but I never seem to write those songs. I'm always trying to get to some kind of existential understanding of myself. So that's not necessarily a comfortable place to hang out.
it's tough, isn't it? I mean, I've always admired that, you know, I was listening to an interview with Nick Lowe where he was talking about the Beast in Me, which is one of my favorite songs of his. And he, you know, he's like, it's just a story. It's not, you know, as you know, somebody who is always, you know, been a fan of examining lyrics, and as a writer myself, as somebody who, you know, to me, writing has always been kind of like an emotional exorcism, you know, where it's like, it's something that you feel you have to get out and it has to go onto the page. And, you know, I definitely have some admiration for somebody who's able to approach it as an other rather than as themselves. But really, I mean, to be that kind of writer and to, you know, for lack of a better metaphor, to bleed onto the page and then to show people your blood and hope that they enjoy it. It's, you know, it's not the easiest thing. And to also put, you know, a catchy tune to it, that's not terribly easy either.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that's where I was watching this great interview with Leonard Cohen the other day, and he's talking about, you know, it taking him 7 years to write Hallelujah, and sort of laboring over that, where other songwriters might be more inclined to go, oh no, this song's got to get done by the end of the day.
Right, yeah.
That's the Nashville writer's room philosophy. It's like, we're going to put four people in here and we're going to
write.
But that's not, I'm not writing songs as an attempt to create characters or to convey some kind of universal message. They're snapshots of my life. so it's whether or not I feel comfortable or how deep I'm prepared to go.
Well, and I think your new song that you put out, Soft Apocalypse?
Yeah.
That's very evident. And there's these very, you know, like beautiful, subtle and simple observations, you know, like, which I've always been a huge fan of, you know, you know, it's why I love Raymond Carver stories. You know, it's talking about the supermarket wine and the cats, and there's definitely a beauty to it. Not that the being able to write like I to go back to the Nick Lowe example, not that being able to write something like that obviously isn't also similarly amazing, but to I think that there is a lot of art that people miss sometimes when it's, you know, the simple observations are often just as difficult to put out artfully, and that there is also something just as intricate and complicated to it if you sort of stand back and really absorb it.
Well, I mean, if we're talking on Nick Lowe, I think one of my favorite songs of his is Lately I've Let Things Slide.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's got Takeaway and, you know.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm a massive fan of his songwriting. Wonderful. Like you, I'm an Anglophile. Very much, particularly my teenage years were spent listening to a lot of Elvis Costello records, because a lot of his stuff got reissued in the 90s. A very big fan of the Smiths, and
sure.
That sort of the Smiths and Jarvis Cocker from Pulp. So, the influence of Suburban Despair.
Yes. Yeah.
Really, has never really left my my mind. I'm very, you know, it's still very, very present in the work that I do.
It's so hard, you know, as somebody who also loves the Smiths, it's really having to be able to appreciate that apart from Morrissey these days. You know,
you have to step outside yourself, don't you? I mean, yeah. I console all my fellow Smiths fans with the fact that Johnny Marr is just a really great guy. And he's definitely 50% of the band.
Absolutely. I
mean,
yeah.
And, you know, I mean, everybody has a shadow side, and in the Smiths, it's Morrissey, unfortunately.
Yeah. You know, he did, you know, he did make some great observations and wrote some lyrics that are indelibly, you know, printed on my psyche. So, you know, you got to give him that, but I don't know. Sometimes you just have to detach and let, you know, something that was created 30, 40 years ago live on its own and be able to just appreciate that.
And you have to let people grow up and become who they want to be.
Oh, of course.
Even if that person is ghastly, you know, thinking with love of all the fans of the Sex Pistols right now, you know.
Right, yeah.
So sometimes our heroes they have no choice but to let us down.
Well, and I think that's interesting too, to think about, as, you know, in the internet age, the age of accessibility and everything, it's much harder to have heroes because you can know too much about them. And the problem, I think, with heroes has always been that once you learn too much about who they really are, they're just bound to disappoint you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's very difficult to sustain mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Age of the internet, and the best artists are able to reveal just enough of themselves to connect with their audience, and not so much that the audience feels like, oh, they may as well be my neighbor Stephen Patrick Morrissey that puts the racist flag in his window.
Right.
Like it's and it's really, really hard to know. I mean, I think about, you know, one of my biggest heroes, I would say, is Patti Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that she does an amazing job of creating a sense of intimacy without giving too much away. And one of the ways that she does that is she always just talks about the things that she loves.
Right.
And yet, there was a video of her on Instagram on John Lennon's birthday of her singing Oh Yoko in her shower. You know, so it's like Patti Smith meets crazy aunt singing John Lennon's shower. But to me, that's fabulous.
Yeah,
but I think it's just deeply challenging, you know, and for everybody in the age of the internet, for a range of reasons.
Well, and it's interesting too, I think, how at its best, I think it can make, you can connect in ways that you might not otherwise be able to, and it can make a large world much smaller. On a weekly basis, you invite people into your home for your Sweet Home Quarantine shows. I mean, which are, you know, fantastic, and for a couple of reasons, because it's as somebody who spent a large chunk of their time going to shows, you know, missing that connection with not just going to listen to music in a live setting, which I think is always the best way to hear it, as you know, as I have thousands of albums behind me here, but, you know, it's still, I think the immediacy of that, and being able to because you're also connecting with the vibe of all the people around you as well. And there's this beautiful shared moment that will never happen again. And so in the absence of being able to go do that, there's this kind of beautiful thing that you and Robin do every week and have people join you, and there is this, you know, this chat where people are also still somehow managing to get at least some aspect of that human connection. And it's very, you know, for something that where nobody is in the same room as anyone else, it ends up being a very intimate thing.
It does. And it's really wonderful to be able to do that. It's absolutely not something that I would have thought that I would be doing. You know, the technology's been there to do internet shows for ages.
Right.
But the need for us is because we're working musicians, you know, our job is going on tour. Neither of us sadly make enough money from royalties to not be on tour, but we both love tour. And the thing about the internet shows in the chat room is that it is that connection. It is that community. It's seeing the names and saying hi to folks and playing requests. And as you say, although there's not that sense of wonderful electric energy that you have when you've got people in a room, what is there instead for me as a performer is I can read a name on a screen and go, okay, Kristen, you wanted to hear this. Okay, yeah, sure, we'll do it. That's fine. Like, where that would never happen at a gig, you know?
Right. Yeah.
I wouldn't call out to the crowd, oh, or someone's got this saying, can you play Queen of Eyes? Yes, we'll do Queen of Eyes. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there's a kind of intimacy of spontaneity that might not be there in a regular show. There's also a silliness because there's something absolutely ridiculous about singing into a computer screen, just as there's something absolutely ridiculous about sitting down on your sofa and watching two people on the computer screen. So there's a lot, we have a lot of fun with that. Because it doesn't, you lose that fourth wall.
Right.
There isn't that sense of there's a sound person and there's a, it's much more like being in a digital folk club.
Sure.
Where you know everybody in the room and then you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like it's a virtual living room show, you know, having people around for you know, I don't know, like a hootenanny or something almost. It is. It's interesting. You know, something that is, I don't know. It's something that will be interesting to see what continues to happen after touring is able to, you know, start again safely, which, you know, at this point, really who knows what the kind of timeline is on that. It's something kind of fascinating to think about as far as what quote unquote normalcy will look like in the future, because it seems like, you know, as many things as we've had to give up and, you know, habits we've gotten into that we've had to lose or alter, that some of this has, you know, not been so bad to have been able to connect with people in a way that you might not. I mean, this podcast, I was always doing and insisting on doing these interviews in person. And, you know, the ability to do what we're doing now, you in Nashville and me in Phoenix, you know, who knows, it would have taken you stopping through Arizona again for us to have this sort of opportunity. And, you know, as much as I value that sort of in-person connection, it definitely opens up a lot of new avenues as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think for us, from our perspective, we will continue to do an online show when the pandemic ends. And one of the reasons for that is for a variety of reasons, that there are all kinds of people who can't come to live shows but can go to a show on a laptop. And that might be due to their health. due to their financial situation, due to their geographic location. Maybe they live somewhere really remote, or it's somewhere right. that you just never go on tour. So I'd like to keep that open to people. And also we really love it. I also have this other fantasy where we have a live show for the people that have attended the lockdown shows. Like just some kind of, probably somewhere where it's kind of in the middle of America in a hub like Chicago, where it's like, okay, everybody who's come to Sweet Home Quarantine, we're going to do two nights in this venue in Chicago. It's only for you. It's not open to the public, and, you know, and just have a bit of a party. And because I know for a fact that there are people who've become friends through this show online that didn't know each other because one's in Minneapolis and one's in Atlanta or one's in New York right. and the other's in Seattle. So, which to me is lovely. Like that community building is really, that's so special.
Oh, very absolutely. Cool. So Dylan, let's talk Dylan for a little bit. Now there's, you know, basically, as long as Dylan has been around, people have been interpreting Dylan, and which is because, you know, he has such a specific voice on his own, and I love Bob Dylan and his music, but there's also, you know, and the originals as he put them out, but, you know, from the beginning, whether it was with Joan Baez or Judy Collins or the Byrds, you know, people have arguably reinterpreted his original work in a way that some might consider, you know, even superior to the original, or if not superior, then certainly something that delivers something that's nuanced slightly different. But I would imagine it can also be daunting because so many people have recorded Dylan over the years. What made you want to tackle his catalog and then cull the 9 songs that you chose to record for your album Blonde on the Tracks?
Well, I mean, in many ways, Dylan covers are a genre unto themselves, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
As you say, there's so many people who have done them. Why do more? But when you think about Dylan, regardless of what he became or has become, he started out as a folk singer. And the great thing about folk songs is that they're sung again and again and again and again. Mm-hmm. and they've always been reinterpreted and handed down through the generations. I think it's only since we started recording music that people kind of got this idea that, oh, the recorded version is the definitive version. Why would you do that? Why would you do this again? it's sort of, and I'm not really... I'm not really fazed by that kind of stuff at all. I went through a very severe period of depression and writer's block in and around 2016 and 2017. And I was living in Nashville at the time, and I was very bored of country music by this point, particularly bored of conversations about what is and what is not authentic, kind of tedious marketing definitions of outlaw, and
oh, sure.
I just really, it just seemed lame. but I was in Nashville, and Dylan had also recorded in Nashville. You know, I saw a lot of people kind of marketing themselves as the next Waylon or the next Loretta or whatever. Mm-hmm. No one had the confidence or the skill to be able to market themselves as the next Dylan.
Right, yeah.
Or even the next Ronstadt. Mm. There hadn't really, and there still hasn't really been, I think we're coming up for a reappraisal of that because a lot more people have been recording covers in lockdown, but interpreting songs had become very uncool. So I guess, but I didn't have any songs to record. So I decided in my cups one night after a few glasses of wine that I was going to do this record and call it Blonde on the Tracks. And Dylan had just released his triplicate record, very specific in the Sinatra reference. And I like specifics. So I'm quite OCD. So I landed upon Dylan. But I could have landed upon Leonard Cohen, or I could have landed upon Lou Reed.
Sure.
Or Elvis Costello. Like, I was never going to do something like Katie Lang's Songs from the 49th Parallel. Or like any Linda Ronstadt record where I kind of just put together a bunch of songwriters, or Emmylou Harris' Wrecking Ball is another one. I like the idea of specifics, and so I went for Blonde on the Tracks.
I actually really like those Dylan records where he was covering standards. I thought that you really got to, because that was really the first time that you could examine him as a performer and as a singer. Cause I think that he beautifully interpreted those songs. There are some of those songs that I had never listened to the originals of, you know, and I thought that was very interesting to see him do that at a point in his career where arguably for many decades he's had nothing to prove as a recording artist, but to put that out and be like, oh, this is what I want to do right now. Recently, there are a small number of people that have put out Dylan covers records that are fantastic. And there are two that I have been revisiting a lot. Yours Since It Came Out, and Brian Ferry's Dylan-esque, where it's one of the tricks, I think, you know, and trick might be the wrong word, but to interpreting a Dylan song is to inhabit it and make it as though, you know, you were the one who wrote it almost. You know, there's something where it's you know, I know that they're Dylan songs. They're famously Dylan songs, outside of the interesting choice to cover a brand new Dylan song. You know, there has to be something of the voice of the singer in there that allows you to appreciate the album for how it is on its own. Otherwise, why are you listening to it? It's just somebody, you know, perhaps with a technically better voice singing some Dylan songs. How did you arrive to that selection of nine and make that choice specifically to add I Contain Multitudes to the set, which had, I believe at the time, it was just relatively recently been released as a single too.
Yeah, I released it before he released Rough and Rowdy Ways. Mm-hmm. It was the second single from Rough and Rowdy Ways. I'm really glad that you like my interpretations, and I'm really glad that you referenced Brian Ferry, because I love Brian Ferry. I'm obsessed with Brian Ferry. I think he's a phenomenal singer and an incredibly charming man, and it goes back to that Anglophile thing of, you know, I just... fan of way back, but I guess the songs that I chose, and I think this is what all good interpreters do, is they have to resonate with your life experience, which is why you don't have me singing songs like Dylan's more narrative songs. You don't have me singing Hurricane. You don't have me singing Idiot Wind, because that's not a really, it's not something that I relate to. I relate to songs of longing and loss and romance and poetry, and that's what I'm about artistically. So that's why that collection appears appears as it does. There's 8 songs on the record, and then I have since recorded. I did a live version. I've made up my mind to give myself to you, just because that fits in with those songs quite well, I think. But I mean, there's so many songs on the great thing about Bob Dylan is there's so many songs that could be on this record, mm-hmm. that aren't there. That I'm just obsessed. I'm totally obsessed with, you know. And then there's songs of his that I love. That again, I love singing for fun in the shower, but they're definitely not going to connect with people. Like Twitter and the Monkey Man, for example. Hands down, one of my favorite Dylan songs. Me singing it sounds ridiculous.
That song's great for knowing that he was trying to take the piss out of Springsteen too. It's just, you know, it's
exactly. and I love Springsteen too, and it's for those same reasons that, you know, if I were to do a whole record of Springsteen songs, I would lean on the romantic songs, and I would leave off things like Born in the USA.
It's interesting. Yeah. There are songwriters that you connect with for, you know, and that people can connect with for so many different reasons. And you know, for me, you know, the Dylan songs that will, if in the right setting, and on several occasions have made me cry, like Simple Twist of Fate honestly, a number of songs off of Blood on the Tracks. But you know, like Springsteen, where my favorite album of his is Tunnel of Love, you know, the more like nakedly, you know, that those are some pretty naked confessions, as you were saying. And I'm curious, you know, I'm also a huge Wilco fan, and you got Pat Sansone to play on and produce, your record. How did you connect with him, and how did all of that come together? Is he part of that sort of Nashville music community?
Yeah. I mean, he's there. He lives in East Nashville and hangs out there. And I mean, he's on tour with Wilco a lot, but he was able to come on board and do this record, which is great. The record also has some extraordinary Nashville players, as well as Robin Hitchcock, you know, my partner, who Robin has been listening to Dylan almost his entire life. So it's like going into the studio with a Dylan encyclopedia, but also someone who's deeply schooled in the folk tradition, and has recorded many of his own cuts of Dylan songs.
His Robin Sings is another one of my favorite Dylan covers albums. Absolutely.
Yeah. So there's, I mean, the great thing about the studio that we recorded in for 2 days, also the guy that owns it is a guy called John Little, who's another complete Dylan head. I mean, they're everywhere. they're everywhere in Nashville, and that's fun. That's fun too. The best thing I would say about working with Pat is that we didn't have to be too loyal to the parts. You know, it was all very much like I didn't want people listening. Like, I didn't tell the band what we were recording before we went to the studio.
No. Wow.
Robin and I played it, these acoustic versions, because I didn't want them going to their Bob Dylan record collections and going, oh, this is how Queen Jane approximately sounds.
Well, that's pretty ingenious, because yeah. Then they're almost, you know, as well as they might know the songs, they're improvising their part of it on the spot.
Yeah, they're not trying to be. We're not trying. We didn't want to recreate
right
sound. But we also didn't want to reinvent the wheel. Like, I didn't want to kind of speed things up unnecessarily.
Well, yeah, I wonder how a sped up version of Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands would sound. You know, but
well,
part of its beauty is in its slowness, I think. So,
yeah.
I just have one more thing I want to cover very quickly, because something that you've been very vocal about recently that has made me reconsider, because I'm an avid record collector. I have always thought that if you love music and love an artist, that what you have to do is support them. And, one of those things is going to their shows when touring is there, and then, buying the albums that they put out. And you have been very outspoken about Spotify and their practices, which artists have been talking about for many years at this point, are not fairly compensating the artists that they are making money hand over fist off of. You made a very bold choice to not have this album available on Spotify and to do a very grassroots campaign for it. And it was, incredibly successful. It entered the charts in multiple countries. You got amazing reviews. And what made you decide to really take a firm stance on that? I mean, it's people have been talking about it for a long time, but you put your money where your mouth is and decided to not make your music available through that avenue.
Well, the first thing I would say is that it was just pure economic necessity. I couldn't afford to put my record up for free, because I'm currently, I have two streams of income, and that's selling records on the internet and playing live shows on the internet. I think a lot of musicians would rather get a side job than tell their fans that their record label doesn't pay them a living wage, right. Which to me doesn't make any sense. And I'm not anti, I think it's important to clarify, I'm not anti-streaming. I do think, however, it's the job of the musician now, or I see it as part of our job, to educate people that streaming is not, it's not actually financially helpful to artists. Mm. And many people just don't know that, because they see these kind of insidious Spotify marketing campaigns that say things like, yay, I got 100,000 streams. And then fans think, wow, that's really cool, they got 100,000 streams. And 100,000 streams is $400. Wow, and that's if you own 100% of the master. If you're signed to an indie record label, that's $200. If you're signed to a major and you're on an 80-20 deal and you're getting the 20, then it's even less. And I think that musicians just aren't willing to talk about that. And I wanted to talk about that. And I've been proud to talk about that. I will say, though, that unfortunately for all musicians, we live in a music industry. We participate in a music industry that still measures the success or the viability of an artist via streaming services. So I will have to put my record up on streaming services. It'll go up on streaming services in December. And one of the reasons I have to do that is because I need to be able to book tours, and I can't get a booking agent to take me on because they don't think that I can go by December. I will have sold 10,000 records, which is impressive for an indie artist.
Yeah.
But no one in the business, that's not enough for them. They want to know where you're streaming. They want to know what playlists you're on.
It seems like the machine is always lumbering and slow to change, right? You've got, because prior to that, it was Billboard success, right? Whether your single was in the charts and how many radio stations were playing it and all that sort of thing. And then it moves to, you know, radio is kind of a dying format, and in most markets is done by a machine. You know, it's not you know, people really making independent choices. To move that to, you know, it's decisions based on how many streams you have and how many people follow your social media accounts and all of these things that just seem, I don't know, it's so difficult to be able to just be able to make art for art's sake and let something live on its own merits when people are tracking these completely external things that have nothing to do with how great your work is. I don't know. I've always had a problem with it. So I thought it was a wonderful thing for you to speak out on that. And I did see that your new single is available on Spotify for people to listen to. So
yeah, it's, I mean, I've put it up everywhere because I do need to broaden that audience at the end of the day. But I think I made a point, and the point is that if you are an artist and you can negotiate into your contract, or if you have a contract, or if you're doing it yourself, it's okay to withhold your record until you recoup.
Sure, yeah.
Your real fans will flock out and buy it, and then you can stream it to kind of pick up more fans so that when you go out on tour, people will, you know, we're in this unique year too that inspired it for me, because had I been trying to tour the record, it would have been really different. I would have put it up so that someone in Phoenix could see my name on a poster and go, "Who is this Emma Swift girl?" and type it into a search engine and listen to it for free. And then they might buy a ticket to the show.
Or buy the album at the show, too. You don't have that outlet to sell.
You know, the merch. And yeah.
Sure.
But it's just in a pandemic year, I think it's worth raising this stuff. You know, in the same way, it's worth pointing out that, you know, Uber and Lyft rip workers off, and Walmart pays terribly, and
When there's the viable Bandcamp model out there, where you can, which seems to, at least based on what I've read thus far, is much more fair to the artist and artist centric, and you know, it would be nice to see something like that continue to gain momentum and all that sort of thing. But you know, again, you put out a beautiful album. The new single is great. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I don't want your dinner to get cold or anything like that. So I will say thank you and let you go here. And it was great talking
Thanks.
To you.
And yeah, we shouldn't go out on a bummer. I think music is great and worth celebrating. And love to everybody in this strange and challenging pandemic year. My gosh, I mean, things are looking brighter now, I think, than they have.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially, it was great to record on a day where we were able to see, you know, the Biden-Harris ticket push over the top, and there's a lot of work to do still, but the fact that change is on the horizon, it's nice to be able to breathe a little sigh of relief too, you know.
It makes me really excited to get back out on tour and travel the United States and just, yeah, feel like things are moving forward.
Right, yes. Well, thank you so much. It was great talking to you. All right, that's it. That's the show. Again, I want to extend a deep, profound thanks to Emma Swift. It was really wonderful talking to her, and I appreciate her taking the time out to have that conversation. Again, Blonde on the Tracks is available through Bandcamp now, as well as starting December 9th, it will be available on streaming services, Spotify, Apple Music, and be sure to catch her live stream, an acoustic performance of songs from Blonde on the Tracks on December 13th on her YouTube channel. If you want to follow this, you know, me on social media, it's at LTD Engagement on Twitter. And it's at LTD Engagement on Instagram, and then at LTD _ Engagement on Twitter. If you would subscribe to the podcast and review it on whatever podcast service you're listening to, that would be fantastic. And hopefully you enjoy your Thanksgiving. I mean, a lot of people are not having to go visit their families this year, and maybe that'll make for some peaceful downtime for you. But stay safe and be careful and be smart too. And do whatever you need to get through. See you on down the road. This has been a Hoon Waddle production. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not check out one of our other fine podcasts available from hootandwaddle.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or any number of podcast apps. If you'd like to support Hoot and Waddle and get access to an exclusive member-only podcast, receive discounts on merch, and more, go to patreon.com/hootandwaddle.